Are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's J&EB webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of S&EB and glad to have you with us today. I'll start us off with a little bit of housekeeping. If you look in your GoToWebinar panel, there is a handout for today. So the slides for today's presentation, you can go ahead and download those and follow along with our presenters. And then just a reminder, we are recording today, so I'll send a follow-up email on Thursday of this week with a link to the recording and then the slide handouts again for you to review. Our moderator today is Dr. Karen Chapman-Novikovsky. She is a professor of nutrition at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and also is editor-in-chief of the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Welcome, everybody. We're having this webinar on writing and reviewing methods papers for JNEB in order to really inform all of you that are an author or potential reviewer for this type of journal article that we have in JNEB. Joining me today is Dr. Susan Johnson. Susan Johnson is a professor in the section of nutrition in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. She is an internationally recognized expert in the area of early childhood nutrition, specifically the impact of the home and childcare environments on the development of young children's eating behaviors and growth. Dr. Johnson has served as an associate editor for us since 2009. We also have Dr. Chris Taylor. Chris Taylor is an associate professor in the Division of Medical Dietetics as well as the Department of Family Medicine at The Ohio State University. His research focuses on dietary intake patterns and risk for chronic disease. Dr. Taylor has served on the editorial board of JNEB since 2011. So I just want to remind you, type in your questions in the chat pod at any time. I'll be monitoring those. We'll try to take some during our presentation and also at the end. And I just want to remind you all the different kinds of articles that we accept and publish at JNEB. We have our research articles, which are original research. We have research briefs that include a lot of our validation and reliability of instruments, as well as smaller, less well-powered research interventions. Research methods you're going to hear an awful lot about in just a few minutes. We have our reports that also extend policy issues relevant to nutrition education and behavior, our articles that review emerging topics as they relate to nutrition education and behavior. Our systematic review follow specific guidelines, and I just want to remind everyone that we have a pre-conference workshop day prior to annual conference in San Diego this summer that I hope everyone attends. We have our perspectives, those were previously called our viewpoints, and then we have our GEMS, which are our great educational materials. More explanation for all of those can be found at www.jneb.org. So some of the basics that we expect from all paper types, we want to have some background to introduce the rationale for the study and the hypothesis or the objective. So that should flow very well and justify that hypothesis and objective of the study or manuscript. Sound methodology is a must. Our reviewers are very skilled at pointing out weak points and limitations, so we like to see that fairly strong. We want results that have an impact for the literature. However, results are not included in our methods papers, and Dr. Johnson will be discussing that, as well as we don't have a discussion for results in our methods papers, so that sometimes throws our reviewers out. Why are you publishing this? There's no results or discussion. And, of course, there's no implications for research and practice in methods papers either. So what are our methods papers? They are really manuscripts that describe the methodologies of multi-year interventions, and we're going to talk about the depth that we expect in that explanation of the methodology. We expect those protocols to have already undergone some kind of review external to the author's institution, so that we're sure it's already had a fairly thorough critique. Although results aren't included in research methods, a discussion should include a brief summary of potential limitations and expected benefits or outcomes. And again, Dr. Johnson will be talking about that in more detail. Oh. All right, I should quit scrolling. We get a lot of questions from potential authors about research methods. If they have a funded project, can they send in their research methods for that and get it published? What if they've already started the study? Can we still publish our methodology? And several more. Don't be shy. Type those into the chat box. But I'm going to turn it over now to Dr. Johnson, who will be discussing implementation science, which is really the foundation of the research methods paper. Susan?
Thanks so much, Karen. I wanted to start out with an overview of just thinking about what implementation science is. I think this is a fairly recent development in terms of how we take our interventions that we craft based on research methodology and then translate them out into practice and into the communities. And I found this quote that's not attributed to anywhere, but that it takes an average of 17 years for only 14% of research to translate into practice. One of the goals of implementation science is to actually facilitate more of the good research interventions that we do and turn them into practices in our various different kinds of communities. Implementation science uses a framework and a model that works on lots of different levels. It can be at the individual participant level. It can be at the community worker or the healthcare organization level. It includes a focus on the context of the level, whether it be the participant or the community, and that context should include factors that will help to make this intervention into a successful translation into practice of particular importance. It focuses on practical aspects of the interventions and the ability to make our interventions generalizable so that they can be used in more than just our research settings. And the reason why I really focus on that, and I have a bullseye next to it, you'll note that bullseye in a number of my slides, and this means that it's particularly important for the topic at hand, and that's developing those methods, manuscripts, and papers. It's the devil's in the details, and considering how one team's intervention can then be translated into interventions to be adopted elsewhere really does focus on that key part about generalizability, and it is important in the development of the methods manuscripts that get submitted to JNEB that we consider how this one study, this one intervention, can be applied across diverse settings. So key points of implementation science include understanding the barriers and facilitators that will drive successful implementation of interventions. It highlights whether they are generalizable, representative, and comprehensive enough to have an impact on public health. And again, that bullseye, the details of the intervention methods need to be available in order to help us make research interventions generalizable to greater community interventions. And that's a key purpose in our methods paper, is to provide those kind of details that generally you don't get the capacity to be able to include in other kinds of manuscripts because of page and word limitations. Implementation science seeks to address a set of complex health issues, and as the researchers who develop these methods and these interventions, it's important to share those details that I was talking about so that we can improve generalizability, and we can increase the number of evidence-based interventions that then can be implemented in real-world settings. Okay, so let's talk a bit about the
Yeah, it looks like we might have lost audio from Dr. Johnson. Hold on a moment, and let's see if we can reestablish her connection. Dr. Johnson, if you may try to look at the audio panel and go to webinar and maybe click once back and forth between the telephone and the microphone and speakers to see if we can get the connection reestablished. Oh, are we back?
There we go. So I'm hoping that everybody has now been reconnected. All of us lost audio capacity there for a while. I apologize about that. I was starting on the aims and hypotheses. Just as in any other paper that you would submit to JNEB, having a clear description of the objectives of the research that you intend to do is critically important, and having those embedded within the literature to support why this particular intervention is being developed. It's important to have clear hypotheses about the expected outcomes of the intervention, and that the hypotheses are linked to the methods and the study design throughout the manuscript. I've chosen the graphic of sort of building a wall here, that each of these individual pieces and the pieces that I will talk about moving forward are individual bricks that go into building a strong wall. So this is the foundation of the methods papers. So to elaborate a bit on research design, it's important to talk about the research design chosen, whether it's an intervention or a prevention study, both are appropriate for our methods papers, whether it's a randomized controlled trial, a crossover design, quasi-experimental, where you would have a control and intervention groups that are compared over time, and whether or not it's a longitudinal design. Each of those the different aspects of the study design should be addressed and articulated within the methods paper. Focusing a bit on sample size calculations, this is a part where oftentimes in the manuscripts that are submitted to us that authors struggle just a bit. To give you some details of what should be conveyed about the sample size calculations, they should include which variables and outcomes that the estimates for sample sizes were derived from. In addition to that, and most people get that point, they supply a variable and then supply the information about how it's powered upon a particular variable. But what's oftentimes left out is why that particular outcome was chosen and why it's critical for the intervention that they're proposing to elaborate upon. If an interim analysis is going to be conducted later on, you need to account for how this will have an impact on the power analysis. Will it be an adaptive design, as an example? And just to give you a couple of details about adaptive designs, an example of that is where you might, as part of your intervention study, do a very small pilot to begin with in order to precisely power your study, and then you would elaborate and create an additional power analysis based on what you found out in your pilot study. So that's an example of an adaptive design. But in addition to which, if interim analyses are conducted, will, for your final analysis, your p-values be adjusted to account for the fact that you've already done previous comparisons? That's an important point to specify in your sample size calculations. What are the limitations in sample size calculations? This can be put into the discussion. The realities of conducting an intervention is that you can account for some things, but probably not everything. It's important to detail in your methods paper why you've chosen what you've chosen and what the limitations associated with it are. So, moving on to participants and recruitment. In most cases, authors are quite skilled at defining where their sample or their reference population is coming from, but supplying the details that are important to know about the participants in the recruitment sometimes do not make it into the first submission of the manuscript. We'd like to know, where are they coming from? What are the inclusion and exclusion criteria? What methods are you going to use to recruit people? So it's, methods are more than just the assessments that you'll use to collect data from your population and for your study. The methods also include how you're going to go about selecting your participants and where they're going to come from. A little bit of information about the informed consent procedures that give you details about the sample to be recruited. And will a data safety monitoring board be required? A DSMB is usually something that will happen for interventions that are clinical in nature. Will screening or pre-screening be utilized, and how will the participants be allocated to the treatment groups? This is a particularly important point. I should have had a bullseye beside it. If they're going to be randomized to treatment groups, details about the randomization scheme are important. Will the conditions be blinded, single-blinded or double-blinded? These are all important points to supply about the participants' recruitment and randomization. Again, another bullseye here. Will an existing intervention program be used? If an existing program or curriculum will be used, is it going to be tailored for your particular study or for your particular participant group? As an example, will usability testing be conducted to make sure that it's appropriate for the target sample?
Susan, before you go there to that next PDSA, so what if your study design, and I apologize for the typo there, that's my fault, not yours, it should be, what if our study design includes the development of the intervention? Because we've seen a number of manuscripts that have come into JNEB where the proposal, which was funded, does not include much detail about the intervention. They're going to develop it as part of their funding source. So can they still publish that sort of methodology?
Yeah, Karen, I think they can publish that. I think what they choose to elaborate on perhaps shifts when the intervention will be under development. Then, if you don't have an established intervention program and you're going to be developing it for your intervention, then you need to focus on the process of how you will go about developing that intervention. Who will contribute to the materials that will be developed? How will that process evolve? Who will you test it out on? So giving that insight into how the intervention and will be developed and who will be developing it and how it will be pretested will become particularly important for that study that is in the process of developing their own intervention.
Thank you.
Okay, so just a word about what a PDSA is in case that's a new term for some of our listeners. PDSA refers to the Plan, Do, Study, Act cycle. And this is oftentimes a quality improvement process where there's a goal of trying to improve some part of the process. And the questions that it helps you answer is to define exactly what you're trying to accomplish, to also be able to articulate when you know that a change results in an improvement in the process, and which changes that you can make that will help outcomes. It's often used in a clinical setting, and it's trying to help move a good operation into an ideal operation or implementation. So it identifies exactly what needs to be changed. It makes an attempt to change it. It evaluates whether or not that change is effective, and if so, implements that change. And a PDSA can be an iterative cycle that's used in clinical interventions.
So, but that's not required in a methods paper, correct, Susan?
It's absolutely not required. It is an option for how an intervention might be developed, however.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. So, the devil's in the details. Intervention details that absolutely need to be elaborated upon in your methods papers include, if it's to be developed, if the program's to be developed, what are the methods, as we were talking about before, that will be utilized to develop those contents? What materials are going to be used in the intervention? And when I talk about materials, I really would like to see how the core components of the intervention have been defined, and how those core components really relate to the objectives of the study and the study outcomes. Again, it's building a thread throughout the manuscript that ties the objectives and the aims and the hypotheses, the design, the materials and core components, and then to the expected outcomes of the study.
Susan, this reminds me of another question that we've had. Do we require a logic model? Because a lot of these materials and activities and, you know, resources and things remind me of that logic model.
There's not an absolute stated requirement for a logic model, but it is something that we have recommended to a number of authors to help them take what can be a lot of information and turn it into a visual or a model, if you will, that helps to bring all of those different components together. So a logic model can be very effective in doing exactly that. That's a great question. Along with the materials to be used in the intervention and how it will be developed, it's important to understanding what the underlying theoretical framework of the intervention is. If core components, when the core components are described, it's also important to understand how those components relate to the evidence base that's already existing in the literature. So this is one of the terms that I found when intervention or methods papers are being described, and I really like the term active ingredients because I think it provides a nice example of how the core components are expected to relate not only to the theory, but there's a reason why they're core, and it's because they have active parts that have to be supplied to make the positive outcomes happen. So, active ingredients are examples of how core components are operationalized and put into practice in that intervention. They have to be described so that we can understand that they are teachable ingredients, they're learnable, and they are doable in the setting that they will be implemented in. So in addition to the active ingredients, we need to understand how the intervention is going to be delivered. And that's not just one part, it's what setting will it be delivered in? Who will deliver the intervention? What's the frequency or how often will different active ingredients be delivered? The intensity and the duration of the intervention.
So I have my question there again, Dr. Johnson. So if we're just developing our intervention, can we just leave this part out? Because we maybe don't know exactly who's going to deliver it or how long the sessions are going to be yet, because we're developing it, right?
Right, and it's true. You may not know all those details, but what you can elaborate on is the process by which you'll determine those details. So yes, some of that will, for some of the interventions, may be a discoverable component, but then it's going to be really important to clearly convey how you're going to be discovering that, the methods of the methods, as it were. So now let's talk a bit about the assessments. And again, this is generally a component that many people feel very comfortable with. It's important to give some details about which assessments will be collected, how were they chosen. And again, part of how they were chosen is going to relate back to those core components and active ingredients. You want to show how you'll capture and link to those pieces, but also to understand upon what criteria the assessments were chosen. And what I'm really referring to there in terms of criteria relate to psychometrics that are already published within the literature that are related to the assessments, validity, reliability, etc. How appropriate those assessments are for the sample that you will be working with in your intervention, and if any tailoring needs to happen to be more appropriate for your specific sample, how you will go about doing that in the study at hand. In addition to all those details about your assessments, it's important to also think about what covariates or confounders that you will measure beyond the measurement of your independent and dependent variables, so that you can adequately capture the effects of your intervention. And what, as an example of what covariates and confounders might be, good examples might be demographic characteristics of the sample at hand and how those could influence your study outcomes. Over and above the assessments of your outcomes, you also need to provide a piece about what process analysis will be conducted. You know, taking you back to some of my first slides that related to implementation science, one of the tricky bits about implementing the results of our intervention studies in a broader framework out in the community is that the details about the process oftentimes aren't included in our manuscripts that talk about the outcomes of our intervention. So things like compliance and how loss to follow-up will be documented, how fidelity of the implementation of the intervention was determined, and those include things like the dose of the intervention, the delivery, the reliability across deliverers. How those individual pieces are assessed is very important for determining whether or not the outcomes of your particular study will be able to be generalized to a broader implementation framework. In addition to the assessments and the process analysis of the intervention, understanding the sampling frame. And what I mean by sampling frame is when will the assessments be conducted? You know, oftentimes that's at baseline and post-intervention, and then there may be another follow-up sampling frame that happens later on. Sometimes a figure can be useful in really connecting the dots for these different pieces and how often they will be collected. Finally, down to data analysis. Circling back to a point that I made earlier, will an interim analysis be conducted? And if so, at what point will that be undertaken? If the intervention is being conducted and an interim analysis is conducted and the intervention is found to be ineffective or for some other reason will be stopped, what will that predetermined stop criteria be? It needs to be very well defined if those conditions are in place. That usually happens more in clinical interventions. What analysis will be undertaken to compare your treatment groups? So talk in detail about your statistics, your covariates and confounders, the unit of analysis, and what your plan comparisons are going to be. In intervention analyses, it's also important to clearly outline whether it will be an intention to treat analysis or a completer's analysis. And how will baseline effects be controlled for in the intervention? You know, one of the things that I've seen come through with some manuscripts is that in intervention designs, baseline measurements are not used as controlling variables for intervention outcomes. And there's specific statistical methods to be able to do that. And I've included a reference to that by Blandon Altman in the resources that are available to you later on in the slide set. And last, this is a piece that is a little counterintuitive to some of our individuals who are preparing methods papers. The discussion section usually involves taking the information from your results and putting it into the context of the literature. And since you don't have any results for a methods paper, people oftentimes stumble on what to put in their discussion section. What should be in the discussion section for your methods papers, which, by the way, is usually briefer than for other kinds of manuscripts, is how you expect the findings from your study to contribute to the knowledge base, to the evidence base. That's one thing, is that your expectations of what the outcomes will add. Another is if you are developing new methods for your intervention, how will those new methodologies add to the existing methodology base? So how might others be able to use the methods that you're developing? In addition to those two points, pointing out what the strengths of your study are likely to be and how you've designed it, and then acknowledging that every study has limitations. We know some of those before we even start our studies, and being very transparent about what you expect those might be. Don't weaken your methods papers. It, in fact, strengthens your methods papers in that discussion to acknowledge what limitations you already expect exist. Sometimes those limitations can be addressed in your analyses, and that a good example of that is relating back to your covariates and confounders.
So, Dr. Johnson, you've included an awful lot of detail and information here, and what we're saying really to authors is probably the methods paper has to have more than what we submitted in the 6 pages or 12 pages of our research proposal.
Yes, I would say so.
And I think that next, as Dr. Taylor is talking about the reviewer, he's going to emphasize this as well, that as Dr. Johnson has talked about what to do when you're writing that, We've also had people say, I don't even know how to review this manuscript. You need to help me out. And so Dr. Taylor has been an excellent reviewer of our research methods papers, and I'm going to turn it over to him to tell you what he looks for.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Excellent job with this, Dr. Johnson. That's a nice piece to transition in. So I'll ditto everything that she says. And originally, I want to look at how we kind of put all this information together. And it's a different kind of paper that we're using for the methods papers, because we're trying to convey something that really helps guide the science. But in reality, this is a lot more of a mechanistic type of paper rather than it is a kind of a what are our key findings and where do we go next type of paper. And we get the question of, well, can't I just submit my grant proposal? And some of the federal grant proposal mechanisms basically have a 6-page proposal where you justify the problem, justify your existence, tell them what your major aims are, and generally how you're going to make that happen. And that's going to overlap a little bit with the executable methodology. And so there's a whole lot more details that Dr. Johnson just spelled out for us that you couldn't possibly have included in the research design in your grant proposal. So that makes it really challenging to then say, well, my grant proposal was reviewed, and they said it was okay, so why isn't it okay for this? Because the intent is to create a much more illuminative picture of what you're actually going to carry out. And what that ultimately does is gives us a little bit of a different piece of this contribution to the science. So we're starting with a piece of the problem. Our design is going to help us address that one piece of the problem. And then that methodology is going to lead into our overall understanding of how we address these problems. And being nutrition education and behavior, it's going to take a lot of interventions, very specific, to help us move forward towards these end products. So
let me just interrupt there for a minute, Chris. And when I look at that last slide, what I see is, if I'm reading a research methods paper, can I in my lab go out and do that?
Right.
We don't have to guess, okay, what are we including in this educational session? What are we measuring? How are we measuring it? Nothing. It's all right there, correct?
Yes. So it creates a nice guidebook for others. And I think that's one of the aspects that we have as far as a challenge for writing grants, is a lot of the opportunities for training and examples tend to be more on the basic science from many of the funding sources.
Uh-huh.
So there aren't as many great examples of designing strong interventions that address all of these aspects that Dr. Johnson has gone over, so that we can move towards that right-hand side of the contribution to the science. So,
and so it should feel like a contribution to science and not like you're giving away your secrets, right?
Yes.
Oh.
Because what this ultimately does is lays the framework to understand all the results that you have coming forward. And it helps to be less frustrating when you have to write that article and they want to know all the details of your methods and all the details of your analysis and all the details of your results and discussion in 2,500 or 3,500 words.
Right. And then it's also helpful to refer back to in the actual results papers, the research articles and briefs, and what you did, how you did it, or even in the limitations and discussion of those future papers as well, correct?
Correct. And it also provides an opportunity for leadership within the field as far as the scholarly avenue, because these papers become some of those same papers that help guide the science in the area. So being able to track the citations of these papers, just like your results papers, allow you to document how the work that you're doing fits into that bigger picture and how it helps to evolve the science where we're going.
Excellent. Great. Thank you.
right. So why isn't the grant proposal enough? Well, we talked about the length, and there's a differing purpose of what it is. And the purpose of a grant proposal is just enough detail to get funded. So you need to convince them that you have a sound idea, that the idea is executable with the team that you have and the resources that you have. And the methods paper really is to give that specific detail, to really give those nuts and bolts, to understand what are the challenges of addressing the problem, what are the measurements that we need to actually make that happen, and then how does this fit in within the broader scope of what we have. And what we might be seeing on some of these is that we have evidence from some of these exceedingly large trials for disease prevention, disease treatment, that have a lot of resources invested in them, of time and people. And how does that then translate into the clinical realm, or the not having enough people around to take 7 weekly phone calls of an hour apiece with each of the participants to make this happen? So ways that we can develop more generalizable interventions that build on some of that initial science that helps shape it forward. So the grant proposal gives you the nice nitty-gritty overview of what's going to happen. The methods paper gives us a whole lot more detail. And again, the length, the page limits, you may not have very many pages to describe these and the methodology. And as part of the grant proposal, you're spending part of your time justifying what the problem is, part of your time justifying yourself, and then part of your time justifying your methodology within the context of that.
And I would just add here also that with some of our earlier research methods papers, the authors did complain. The reviewer and the editor want so much more detail. How can I keep it within that page limit? And so we did increase the page limit to 19 pages from the 14, I believe it was before. So I would just urge those authors out there that what you really want to do is, you know, put in all the detail that you can, even if you have to ask for additional pages.
Great. And that means that the bulk of this manuscript that you're really putting together is to create that picture of what you're trying to create. So if you've got 19 pages, you're going to be spending most of that time on the intervention elements. You give a little bit of a background as to why the problem is a problem and how this leads in, but a lot of the things that you discuss as parts of your methods design are going to be answering the questions and the issues that are part of the background piece. So you're going to be spending most of your space, probably more than you're getting for a grant proposal, solely on describing the details of the methods within this broader paper. Okay, so as a reviewer and not being trained well in telepathy, I can only evaluate the information that's in front of me. And what happens is here are all these things that everybody wants in the paper, so here they all are. And there is my pile of Lego bricks. And as a reviewer, it's really hard for me to look at those and say, all right, what are you trying to tell me again? How do these things all fit together? How does that actually create a picture? Because we identify each one of these individual elements. We've given you this piece here, check off that box, and now we're going to move on to the next thing. And then I recruit people, and here they are, and I check off that box, and I move on to the next one. All right, I'm going to obviously measure these 74 assessments because we've gotten lots of money and we can measure 74 things. So it makes it very difficult for the reviewer to kind of put that picture together on the right with all the components there on the left. So my key aspect in this, and I'm a mystery novel reader, and I get really annoyed when I read a mystery novel. I get to the end and I find out it's the person that washed the car window on page 4 that never really kind of got discussed otherwise, and then all of a sudden they're the most important character. The key elements of the paper really need to start sequentially from what's the problem we're trying to address? What's that scientific gap? That should then feed into the research objective. So if it's a theoretically based design, that theory should carry out through. There's a very important aspect of the theory, so this guides it, and then you never talk about the theory again. So how do those key aspects pervade all the way through the document? And these visuals that Dr. Johnson spoke about should give you an opportunity to look at that and say, how well does the information that I have in the background tie to my research objective? How does that research objective then tie to my specific design to answer that problem? Then how is my intervention specifically addressing the design and the objective? And then how do those measurements or assessment of outcomes fully tie back directly to what it is that we're trying to accomplish? So that line should follow all the way through, that every one of those pieces should build on each other and help explain the previous steps so that you understand the process all the way through, rather than it being just kind of that collection of elements together that you get it, right? So I wanted to put up the requirements for the research methods papers again, just because it gives a kind of re-anchors us a little bit into what it is that we're trying to accomplish, and that it's the introduction, methods, and discussion. So that key thing that's making all of our researchers tick their head to the side a little bit right now is the fact that results is missing. So everything that we're doing in this paper focuses around that central part of methods, because that's the key. So it may be premature to develop the methods paper until you have enough of the information fleshed out to actually describe the methods. So because we've had a little bit of conversation about where the methods are and how you'll develop those and the method of making the methods, but that's the key aspect of what the paper is. So as a reviewer, if you're not sure what your methods are as of yet, it's going to be very hard for me to understand how it fits within the contribution to the science if you haven't gotten to that piece yet that you can convey it. So again, the introduction is basically the same idea. What is the major problem that we need to address? This sets that tone and creates that story for the rest of the document that's coming forward. The methods section is basically the same. This is the information from the JNEB website. It's the same type of information, but you have so much more room to describe and really convince the reviewer that this is how we really need to address this problem. This is what we can do that's going to help us solve this problem. And then the discussion, again, is not going to be about interpreting your results in context of current knowledge, but what are the strengths and potential limitations of the design that you have moving forward? It might be that some of the previous evidence that we have addresses things that aren't clinically relevant, aren't able to be executed within a community setting. So this may be ways that we're building on the previous science to address the problems that we have and move forward. And perhaps what are the anticipated outcomes of the study? What is it that you hope to see as a result of this that's going to lead forward? And what may be some of those strengths and limitations that may impact the outcome? So, I think we're set for questions.
I did what you did, what you said you didn't want to do, Chris, and I was muted and talking away, and I apologize. Thank you very much. We didn't really get any questions in the chat pod. I'm sure that everyone is thinking about writing a paper, and I do want to add that if you have questions, Dr. Johnson is the editor who handles all of the research methods papers at this time. The process for that review, they first come into me. I give a quick look at them before having them assigned to Dr. Johnson, who does a more thorough read of them. At that time, she decides whether or not they are good enough to be sent out to our reviewers. And if she does, then they go to one board of editor and myself for a more thorough critique of those papers. We like to include only two reviewers instead of three on our research methods because we do like a quicker turnaround and decision time on these, although our decision time on all of our manuscripts has really improved over the last year quite a bit. Dr. Johnson, would you like to comment on that process?
Ask me that one more time, Karen. I have to admit I was distracted by the questions coming in the question box, and I wanted to make sure that you were seeing that those questions are there.
Oh, I was looking in the chat pod because the question box is so hard for me to read. It's a little bitty box. So if a protocol has been externally reviewed by a national agency but not yet funded, is it acceptable to submit as a research methods manuscript? Dr. Johnson, do you want to take that one?
I think that part of our policy thus far has been to have the methods papers be submitted after they are reviewed externally and funded externally, because part of our process for those papers is to try to very quickly get those methods papers to press once they're accepted. And one of the things that we have done to decrease that time frame is to make sure that they have been peer-reviewed and accepted by an external agency.
Okay, thank you. So we have a comment also or a request, and actually a couple of those relate to research groups that have submitted their research methods papers to JNEB, and JNEB declined interest in them, and they're wanting to know if they can resubmit having gone through this webinar, and I have to say a definite maybe. Definitely know why you want to have that published, and I think that if you want to work on that and resubmit that, Dr. Johnson and I will take a look at it. Part of the problem here is that we want more detail than what you did in your grant, and yet we don't want to be a co-author. So if we don't want to be telling you, oh, you need to include this and you need to include this and how you should write it and so forth. So, you know, I think that's a general comment there. What about if you test the tool for inter-rater reliability? Where should the results of this reliability analysis be in the paper if there is no results part? Dr. Johnson?
I think that it depends on what point in the process that you're in. If you are still developing your intervention and in the process of making sure that your assessment tools are appropriate for your group, you can report the method that you went through to obtain those inter-rater reliabilities within your methods section. If this is an outcome of an intervention that's already being implemented, then it should probably wait for a results section in a future paper.
I would agree with that. We have another question about the request to use future tense. They're writing a research methods paper right now, but they're halfway through the project, and it seems really awkward to use the future tense. I know you and I have talked about that. Our reviewers feel uncomfortable with that, and we prefer the future tense, but I think that if you can make it consistent through the paper is more of an issue for myself. Dr. Johnson or Dr. Taylor, do you want to weigh in on that?
From a reviewer standpoint, whatever way makes the most sense and the most logical presentation. I think that's going to be the biggest piece, because if the reviewers are confused, is it happening? Did it happen? This didn't. You're in the middle of the process now. We're trying to figure out exactly where you are in the process and why it's changing. I think those are going to be the elements that will lead to confusion on the reviewer side. So that's why I think with some of the details of the more you have to leave up to, well, we're still thinking about this, leads to the same kinds of issues with grant review as it does with the methods paper, is that this is supposed to be guiding the science. And if it's the written as I think we're going to, but we haven't yet and we're planning on, those, but we've already done this, that's where some of that confusion starts to set in, that then makes it a little bit hard to evaluate the bigger picture.
And, Dr. Johnson, do you agree?
Well, I'll add one piece to that, and I would agree with you that there's not always a one size that fits all, and it may in part depend on whether you are employing an intervention for which you've had to develop the intervention components. Then I can see where not all of it's going to be in future tense. But if it's the case where you're using a standardized curriculum or an already published curriculum, and you're simply in the process of being, for example, midway into your study, I think you can still write that in future tense because you don't have results to convey yet. And while it may seem awkward to you, it's only because you're in the experience of being in the middle of your study. The person who reads your article is not going to have that experience. So be very certain to evaluate whether it's just awkward because it's your lived experience or whether the reader's going to struggle with it.
Mm-hmm. Another question that came in early on was, can methods papers focus on development of evaluation tools rather than an intervention? And the answer to that is no. Those evaluation tool pieces are the instrument reliability and validation papers. Those are research briefs for JNEB. So, no, it does need to be an intervention. And I think...
But Karen, can I interject and highlight the conclusion of what your answer was? It's not that those papers can't be submitted to JNEB. They're just not methods papers.
Right. A research methods paper really is on the methodology for an intervention. Development of evaluation tools fall into the realm of research briefs. We certainly do publish those. Even looking at the development evaluation of your activities, we publish those as GEMS, great educational materials. They're shorter. We want to focus more on the activity or the what's the right word? The material, like what you're doing in that session, rather than the outcomes, although it has to have some kind of evaluation there. It's not as rigorous. Dr. Taylor, final concluding thoughts. We do have the resources here that Dr. Johnson put together for everyone to read through. Any other thoughts as far as your reviewing of the research methods papers?
I think I would echo Dr. Johnson's comments about the usefulness of the images and the graphics that you can use to depict what's happening. I mean, the consort flowchart for randomized clinical trials basically tries to personify where people are, how they get in, how they move through the intervention. A picture is worth 1,000 words, and 1,000 words is probably, what, 5 pages? So, but if it helps us understand what it is that you're doing, and you have the people who are visual learners are going to be the ones that are going to be most helped by those graphical depictions, it helps you then create that story that goes from start to finish and give us a better representation of what you're kind of making happen. beyond just the specific individual details.
Great, thank you. Dr. Johnson, final thoughts?
My final word is to encourage each of you to consider moving forward with this type of a paper. It's very useful for the field. It's useful for your future work as well. And while it seems a little unusual the first time you do it, the authors who have gone through the process have been enthusiastic in the end, so I encourage you to hang in there.
Thank you both so very much. And now I'm going to turn it over to Rachel Dagher.
Excellent. Thank you. Just a reminder that we did record today's session, so you'll receive a copy of the recording by email. I'll have that out by Thursday along with the slides. Might be something that you want to review in the future or share with some of your colleagues. And then also just mention that we have a couple SNEB webinars coming up, including an international-focused webinar that starts pretty early, 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. So look at the SNEB website if you're interested in registering for any of those presentation. As Karen mentioned, there are several JNEB focused sessions at conference, including an editor's coffee as well as the pre-conference workshop, and those details are online as well. Thank you.